Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is United States v. Wilson and other defendants. Mr. Goodman.
May it please the court. My name is Adam Goodman. I was appointed by this court to represent Darryl Wilson, but this morning I'm representing all of the defendants with regard to the Brady and Booker issues, and then Ms. Evans is going to briefly address some of the issues particular to Mr. Armstead's appeal. The district court abused her discretion by failing to award the defendants who went to trial a new trial after the Epps letters or notes were discovered. There is no dispute that Mr. Epps was the key witness in the government's case. Even Judge Pallmeyer, in rejecting the motion for a new trial, described Mr. Epps' testimony as the centerpiece of the government's case. And while there was lots of evidence introduced at trial of drug sales, indeed Mr. Wilson himself pled guilty to four counts of drug sales, there was not a plethora of evidence with regard to drug conspiracy. The defendant's theory at trial, in the main, was that the defendants and the other alleged co-conspirators who had pled guilty or been dropped from the various indictments had competed with each other in the sale of cocaine and other narcotics at the Rockwell Gardens, and that competition was inconsistent with conspiracy. And in light of this, these notes, which were suppressed, were not produced until after the trial, were probably the best evidence, the best single piece of evidence the defendants had and could have offered at trial.
Well, how do you show prejudice? As you indicated, Judge Pallmeyer said it was the centerpiece of the government's case, this particular witness. But she also said that there was a lot of testimony, substantial evidence against the defendants. So how do you show prejudice?
Well, I think that these notes were qualitatively different than any other evidence that was introduced at trial or that was available to be introduced at trial. They show, in graphic language, a plan on the part of Mr. Epps to punish his enemies and reward his friends by lying and thereby structure the prosecution. And these notes were not, the defendants do not think that it's fair to view them as harmless or cumulative, because neither the government nor the district court, despite Judge Pallmeyer's assessment that there was lots of other evidence against these defendants, neither Judge Pallmeyer nor the government had offered a single piece of comparable evidence demonstrating a plan or plot on the part of Mr. Epps to structure the prosecution in such a way to punish his enemies and reward his friends.
When did these notes become known to the defense?
The government provided them to the defendants approximately 2 weeks after the trial. They formed the basis for motions for new trials, which were denied contemporaneously with the sentencing hearings.
And what specific words in the letter show, or these notes show, that he's willing to lie and perjure himself?
Well, and I'm reticent to use the exact words in the courtroom. Some of them are quite vile, but they explicitly claim that he had this is on page SA-45, the first page of the notes, the third to last page of Wilson's brief. I tried to free a lot of guys, but they had already made statements. If they would have remained quiet, they would be free. I got Aaron off the case and proved to them, presumably the government, the prosecution, we never had something dealing. Then he talks about how he didn't want to punish his wife or other people, but he wanted to get specific other people. This is four or five lines up. But I'm going to get Sundown, Bullock, and Jello. I don't want to, vulgar phrase, no one I grew up with in that, or my mom, wife, and child. I know we got them that. These notes demonstrate in graphic form that the defendant the defendant Epps, as part of his plea agreement, was not necessarily being sincere, that he was acting as sort of the puppet master and viewing the prosecution as a marionette, that he was structuring things to punish his enemies, his rivals within the...
Do we know when those notes were prepared or written?
I do not. The government, or Ms. Evans, who were involved in the trial, may know, but I was appointed by this court. Neither the government nor the district court has pointed to anything comparable. The government, in its brief, says, well, Mr. Epps was a bad person. There was lots of evidence that was fronted suggesting that he is a bad person. He beat people up and so forth. And they point briefly and in passing to the fact that he had introduced an affidavit in an attempt to free a defendant named Albert Spann. But the government's analogy to Mr. Spann is not persuasive. Mr. Spann had, according to Mr. Epps, threatened to kill his mother. And Mr. Epps testified on both direct and cross that that was the reason why he had prepared this sort of half-hearted affidavit attempting to exculpate Mr. Spann.
Well, doesn't that show that he was willing to lie to get his enemies convicted? That's the point of that false affidavit that was provided. So he was subject to cross-examination on that issue.
Right? Well, this would actually have been the opposite, I believe, Your Honor. He introduced a false affidavit to try and acquit someone who was threatening his, according to him, threatening to kill his mother. And our position would be that that's not analogous, that there's a difference between that overt threat, which makes that rationalizable in the minds of the average juror. Moreover, the fact that these notes were confidential and private, they were to be passed to other people at the MCC, that there's a the jurors would have concluded that he was being more frank and forthright in these private communications than in this contrived affidavit.
But Mr. Goodman, it seems to me that at the end of the day, what you're trying to prove from these notes is that Mr. Epps is a liar. And the district judge, looking at the record as a whole, I think quite accurately says, at least from the parts of the record that I've been able to unearth, that the jury had a huge amount of evidence in front of it to show that Mr. Epps was a liar. He admits that he's lied to people. He's in cross by defense counsel for Collins. He says living a lie didn't bother you at all. Did it? Deceiving them for more money? No, it didn't. You know, this jury certainly knew that Epps was the type of man who would lie. And in that sense, I think the district judge was trying to say, this is cumulative evidence. It's a different way of showing that he's a liar. Maybe it's an even nastier kind of lie that he's willing to manipulate his associates that way. But what else could you get out of this other than convincing the jury that he was lying?
I think that it's a qualitative difference.
But what did you want to prove? You just wanted to prove he was lying, right?
Right. But more than that he was a liar generally, that he had... he had announced a plan to implicate his enemies and reward his friends, and that could have allowed evidence to have been introduced about Mr. Epps' personal relationships with these defendants, which would have allowed them to suggest to the jury that they were in the enemies category. And even if they were unable to do that, Your Honor, it is well known that, just as in the cases involving the state court judges who took bribes, there's the theory that sometimes people react more harshly to other people in order to maintain their credibility vis-a-vis their dishonest acts. Therefore, Mr. Epps might have, even if he did not have a personal animus with these defendants, might have wanted to implicate someone to avoid implicating his friends, given that even if his enemies had otherwise pled guilty. I'd like to turn to the Booker issue. The government confesses error with regard to Wilson and Armstead and alleges at minimum that a limited Palladino remand is appropriate. However, we would go further on behalf of Mr. Wilson and argue that harmless error review is appropriate because trial counsel adequately articulated a Sixth Amendment objection. The government's cryptic argument to the contrary, unsupported by any authority, that Mr. Wilson's trial counsel did object to the use of evidence not demonstrated before the jury, not subject to cross-examination. And the government does not really argue anything to the contrary. All the government says is that the prerequisites for establishing harmless error review have not been satisfied, but they do not explain what they are, and they do not really grapple with the fact that prior to the Booker decision, this court itself has held that it would have been frivolous to make a full-fledged Booker argument, and therefore one cannot say that arguments are waived by virtue of not having been fully established if it would have been frivolous and perhaps even sanctionable to have done so.
But even on a Palladino remand, people are regularly proffering to the district court evidence under the 3553A factors that could now be considered, let's say, prohibited categories from the past. So I don't know that the Palladino remand requires the district court to ignore what that broader record would be. The district court is, you know, can be informed, can even hold a hearing.
Well, we wrote, as the court may know and can observe from what's in front of you, we wrote our opening brief in May of 2005. The manner in which the district courts are handling this had not been as well developed. There have been subsequent decisions
right,
of
yeah.
this court. Nonetheless, I think that Mr. Wilson has adequately preserved the issue and is entitled to a full resentencing hearing. Moreover, even if in the wake of Palladino, Palladino has moved closer to the arguments that we set forth in our brief almost 2 years ago, both from this court and in the district court, I think our as-applied challenge to Palladino is still worthy of consideration. The government completely ignores all facets of the challenge. There is a procedural due process norm that when case law changes, a party has a constitutional right to supplement the record. That's recognized in civil cases, and there is no reason why the same norm should not apply with even greater force in criminal cases. Indeed, Mr. Wilson was sentenced to life in prison. This court recognized in Bullock that he was the only one of the dozens of defendants in this prosecution who received life in prison. And moreover, Mr. Thomas was explicitly marked out by the district court as a minor participant. I will cede the rest of my time to Ms. Evans.
Ms. Evans?
May it please the court, my name is Demetrius Evans, and I represent Sammy Armstead. I was appointed to represent him in the appeal, but I also represent him at the trial level. Just like to acknowledge that his family is here, Your Honor, and Your Honors, and I believe that's important to do because the issues that we are dealing with, these drug conspiracies overall, have had such a strong impact upon the communities, and that is the African-American communities, and more specifically African-American males, that I believe as these cases come before Your Honors that there should be special consideration taken because it is affecting an entire generation. In fact, I believe that there, from what I'm reading with the Sentencing Commission, there is really an outcry from the community, and I believe that it stems, though I don't want to put on your shoulders the burden of being a social court and having to make changes for the society, I believe that we are responsible. We're all responsible as justice, as the gatekeepers, to be in control and to make sure that what the trial courts are doing is proper in that way. And I know that you all do that. Just an aside. This conspiracy began, I believe, early in the 1990s. We're talking about Rockwell Gardens on Chicago's West Side, and the gangster disciples were watched. There were video cameras that actually watched what went on. This is important to me because the actual case doesn't begin until August of 1999 and concludes around October of 2002. Now, Mr. Armstead was actually not around the Rockwell Garden, not even in Chicago, until October of 2001. And he was charged with the conspiracy overall, and the government proved that there was at least 1.5 kilograms. One of the arguments that I made during my post-trial motions throughout the case, and I've also indicated in my briefs to this court, is that he was only there for a third of this conspiracy.
But the district court's findings show, 1.5 kilograms is actually not very much. It's 3.3 pounds. And the district court's findings, I think, make it clear that even during the time he was physically there, the conspiracy, and he is a reasonably foreseeable to him, dealt well in excess of that. And even if he wasn't physically there, it's certainly the case that sometimes people have continued their membership in a conspiracy from other locations, even prison.
Well, there's no evidence during the trial that he was involved in the conspiracies or even the gangster disciples during the time that he was not in Chicago. So I believe that the government's evidence didn't involve Sammy Armstead at all until October of 2002. What the district
but
court
then, but then once he I gets mean, involved, yeah, but once he gets involved in 2001, he's there totally. I mean, he describes the drug hierarchy. He's getting members to try to sell the drugs during certain days of the week. He's threatening to punish those who don't make their quotas. And he's taking complaints about how things work. I mean, I understand it's just, according to you, a limited period. But when he's in there full force. And there's really no, you don't really have any authority that says that just because you're there for a limited time, you know, you can't be convicted of conspiracy, do you?
No, Your Honor, but you do have case law by this court that says that it should be reasonably foreseeable if you are going to be charged with all the narcotics that you knew this was going on. Here's the problem. When he comes there, there is this meeting. I believe that's what you're talking about,
right,
for Horan Park. That meeting is on October the 2nd. The meeting itself, no one has any idea what happened in the meeting. As a matter of fact, the tapes were so off. This is on page 8 of my reply brief. The court says, I think everybody knows that those tapes are pretty frocky, that they're pretty fuzzy, and certainly the jury has listened to them. And I don't tell you what you ought to argue, but at a minimum, I would expect an argument from the defendants that, you know, it's very hard to hear what's going on. I mean, and what's going on is somebody has on a body wire. The meeting is allegedly outside. It's near a highway. You can't hear anything. It's so awful. So the government, what they do is they have Mr. Epps, who we know is the complete liar that he is, admits that he is the liar, and he lays out a transcript saying, oh, this is what's said. When he's cross-examined, he actually admits that after 19 times, he's looked over his transcripts. So I'm cross-examining him. And there happens to be another transcript where names change. There's all kinds of issues, and I laid that out in my reply brief, where things that are supposedly being said by Mr. Armstead are now being said by someone else. I mean, it just changes back and forth. This is the last point I'd like to make before I sit down, that, Your Honors, these transcripts, from my experience in the federal courts, in the trial level, the issue of the transcripts is the biggest problem in the sentencing guidelines right now. The government has changed them. They brought them back in. They're not completed. And there's no way, once you're in trial, unless the transcripts are barred, there's no way to argue against them. So it means I could come here and say anything on this tape. If you can't hear it, I get a transcriber to write it up, and then that's what's said. The district court allowed that transcript to go to the jury because they can't hear the tapes.
Ms. Evans, you're probably cutting into your co-counsel's
time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Chris Veach. I'm an assistant United States attorney, and I represent the government in this matter. We'd like to start with the issue of concerning the Epps notes. The district court did not abuse its discretion in in denying the defendant's motion for a new trial based on the discovery of the Epps note. First of all, the Epps notes are not exculpatory. They have been attached to opposing counsel's brief. In looking through them, there's nothing in here that indicates in any way that Sammy Armstead, Darrell Wilson, or Stevie Thomas did not commit the offenses as charged.
When were those notes prepared?
Your Honor, I was not trial counsel on this case, and it's not in the record.
All right. When were they? They were delivered 2 weeks after trial?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe about approximately 16 days after trial.
Possession of the government?
Yes, they were, Your Honor. The government does not dispute that it was in possession of these notes and turned them over after trial.
Well, why weren't they turned over earlier?
It is my understanding, again, this is not in the records, my understanding that the trial counsel inadvertently had them on his desk. They were produced to the government under separate cover, and they were on his desk and not included with the other discovery that was produced. It is the government's.
But when you say they weren't exculpatory, I mean, you know perfectly well that impeachment value is also a reason why Brady material needs to be turned over, and these certainly had impeachment value.
Your Honor, it is our position that if there is an impeachment value, it's very limited. There's nothing in the Epps notes that indicate that Mr. Epps is intending to lie. He does say that he was going to get Sundown, Bro C, and Little C, or Bro Lock and Little C. However, there's nothing in there that indicates that he was going to lie about them.
Well, we know that Epps had disputes with Wilson and Armstead, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, and Wilson's complaint got Epps demoted, and Armstead was the one who actually demoted him. Isn't it reasonable to assume that Epps is biased against them and to read those notes in that context?
Your Honor, but again, there's nothing in the notes that indicate that he was going to provide false information about people that he had no regard for. It just shows that he was willing to provide incriminating information about those people, and while he was, he at least vocalized an intention to try and protect other people. There's nothing here to indicate he planned on lying. And to Your Honor's point, there was absolutely evidence before the jury that there was some bias by Mr. Epps against Mr. Wilson. There was evidence that Mr. Wilson had called the police against Mr. Epps, that Mr. Wilson had gone and gotten Mr. Epps demoted through through Sundown. There was evidence before the jury of bias, Your Honor, evidence of bias that these notes do not show. And as far as bias as to Mr. Armstead, I believe the evidence before the jury was that at that point Mr. Epps had stopped participating in the drug sales at the 340 building, and it was a mutual. Mr. Armstead said, well, I don't want you to be assistant governor anymore because you're not really involved. That's the situation there. There was not really any talk of animus between the two at the point of the demotion. It was Sundown who originally demoted Epps based on Wilson's complaint.
But, you know, there's a very manipulative tone to these notes, and I'm not sure why your reading is the only reading. He says, among other things, I tried to free a lot of guys, but they had already made statements. If they something had remained quiet, they would be free. I mean, there's a tone of him being the puppet master here, and if the jury had heard that, they might well have decided that he was targeting his testimony in one direction or another.
And, Your Honor, as the district court pointed out in its order, the facts that Mr. Epps improperly communicated with his co-defendants, urged them to recant their admissions and go to trial, and boasted about his own wisdom and abilities, for example, that he could get people off the case, were known to the defense counsel and were the subject of cross-examination at trial. So this is information of whether Mr. Epps was boasting to this co-defendant who he sent this note to that he was more important than he really is. That information was before the jury, that he was in that position and that he had communicated with co-defendants to recant their testimony and go to trial. That was all presented at trial.
And I assume that was subject, because I didn't review all the closing arguments, that was subject of the closing argument, that particular argument about him and being a liar and being manipulative and all those things.
Your Honor, I apologize. I do not recall. Presumably it was. I do not recall if it was part of the closing argument.
Because it seems to me that, you know, to say he's a liar generally or that he's getting a deal and he has incentive to cooperate isn't the same as evidence that he's using that cooperation to get his enemies. That's not the same, is it?
No, Your Honor, but again, there's no indication that he's doing anything improper by getting his enemies other than being willing to cooperate and provide information against them.
But there might be something improper in trying to get people off, looking at this group as a whole.
Well, and again, Your Honor, he does, for example, he makes mention of an errand, and the government submits from the pretrial that one of the defendants, from the pretrial services report, there's a mention of a related case of Aaron Knight. It's the government's position that Mr. Epps did not, in fact, get Aaron off the case, that Mr. Knight was, in fact, indicted in a separate case and pled guilty and was sentenced. So it is not as if Mr. Epps has actually done anything to get anybody off this case, or at least there's no evidence that he has.
But the issue is whether he's trying to, whether, he's in a strategic way directing his lies to get his enemies and to say less or nothing about his friends.
Well, and Your Honor, we believe that there was plenty of evidence before the jury that Mr. Epps had executed a false affidavit to that was exculpatory of one of his co-defendants and had tried to convince other defendants to not cooperate with the government.
What evidence was there that Mr. Epps was the type of person who would falsely testify that somebody was guilty? You know, X sold the cocaine, not Y, where X didn't really do it.
Other than the general evidence that he was a bad guy who lied a lot and had a substantial reason to lie at trial, specifically as the defense counsel brought up, he avoided a life sentence by cooperating with the government. There was no explicit evidence that he was going to lie to the jury. But again, the government's position is this note does not indicate that he intended to lie either. As to showing of bias with regard to Mr. Thomas, as I discussed, there was already evidence before the jury as to bias between Mr. Epps and Mr. Wilson. There was no evidence of bias towards Mr. Thomas. There was nothing presented at the trial that there was any animus between the two. And again, this letter, the Epps notes, suggest nothing that Mr. Epps had an actual bias towards Mr. Thomas. In fact, he'd known him for 25 years. In addition to not being exculpatory, it's the government's position that the Epps notes are not prejudicial. Specifically, Mr. Epps, while he was a major portion of the government's case, was certainly not the only witness, as the district court pointed out. There was the testimony of three cooperating defendants, Trevon Banks, Tyree Collins, and Daquan Butts, the two law enforcement agents, and audio and video recording of some of the drug transactions and other meetings.
These audio recordings are pretty awful.
Well, Your Honor, I believe Mr. Armstead has only taken issue with one of the audio recordings. That would be the audio recording of the October 2nd, 2001 meeting. And I would point to the record, or as cited in the government's brief, during the trial, Mr. Armstead had proposed presenting a voice identification expert as a witness. Prior to allowing this expert to testify, he was voir dired. And as Mr. Armstead's own witness testified in the voir dire, after reviewing the Epps transcripts, he found them to be fairly accurate and that the portions during which Armstead was alleged to have been speaking was audible in terms of verbiage. So we take issue with Mr. Armstead's position that the October 2nd, 2001 tapes were completely inaudible, especially in light of the fact that his own expert found that the portions during which Mr. Armstead was supposed to be speaking were accurate or audible in terms of verbiage.
That's a very awkward way of putting perhaps the common sense concept, you could hear what he was saying. Is that what audible in terms of verbiage means?
Your Honor, I apologize. That's just a quote from what the witness said. I assume that is exactly what he meant, but I was quoting.
Going to a lot of trouble to say something.
And some of these other recordings were phone conversations, and there was no problem with audibility on those, right?
There were no issues at least raised that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Yes, that is correct. As far as other evidence, these other witnesses...
Transcript used for those as well?
Yes, Your Honor. The transcripts were introduced. And again, throughout the trial, the judge repeatedly instructed the jury that the tapes were the evidence and that any discrepancies between the tapes and the transcripts should be found in favor of the tapes. And there was a specific jury instruction instructing the jury that the tapes were the evidence.
How many tape-recorded conversations were introduced against Armstead?
Your Honor, I don't know the number off the top of my head. I can go through and count,
but a rough estimate.
In total, I believe there were six or eight tapes admitted, and probably three involving conversations directly with Mr. Armstead, three or four involving Mr. Armstead. But I honestly, I do not recall.
All right.
But there certainly were other face-to-face meetings with mm-hmm. Mr. Armstead that were recorded between Tyree Collins and Mr. Armstead that Mr. Collins testified about. And these meetings and telephone conversations, and going to the prejudicial portion of the Brady analysis, Mr. Armstead explicitly is asking Tyree Collins to obtain drugs for him, and he's persistent, and he insists that he will pay Mr. Collins for these drugs and insists that he has other locations to sell these drugs and that he's has been selling drugs and been getting drugs from other gangs. So as far as whether there was sufficient evidence without Mr. Epps' testimony, the government believes that there was, that it was not prejudicial as to Mr. Armstead. There are the recordings of Mr. Armstead at the October 2nd, 2001 meeting where he's instructing the members of the gangster disciples to continue to sell Nation's work.
He at that point is a governor, is that correct?
It is about that time period that I believe that he's been appointed governor, yes, Your Honor. He's just been back in Chicago and has been appointed a governor. In addition, there are the conversations between Mr. Collins and Mr. Armstead in which Mr. Armstead is again discussing trying to get drugs. So as far as prejudice against Mr. Armstead, Mr. Epps' testimony, while an important portion of the government's case, there were recordings and other witnesses who testified about Mr. Armstead that are more fully set forth in the government's brief. As to Mr. Wilson, Mr. Wilson pled guilty to the substantive counts, to dealing crack cocaine at the 340 building. And in the plea hearing, he admitted that he's working with other people, that other people are either fetching drugs for him, or he's going to other people to get drugs, or he's instructing others how to produce the drugs to the agent. That alone would be sufficient to show that he's conspiring with at least these two or three other people at the building to distribute crack cocaine.
Well, alternatively, do you think that alone would have been enough had you not included the conspiracy charge to have brought in these other amounts as relevant conduct?
Yes, Your Honor. The other drug amounts is to Mr. Wilson?
Mr. Wilson, yeah. He pleads to the three, as you said. And if that were the only amount that he was actually sentenced for, it would have been a much smaller amount.
Yes, Your Honor, but I believe it would be the government's position that given his position in the gang, in the drug conspiracy and obtaining drugs for the other members and distributing drugs, even if he had not been charged with the conspiracy, it would still be relevant conduct given his actual conduct involved in the case. And again, the actual conduct described by the other co-defendants who testified, not just Mr. Epps, that Mr. Wilson received Nation's work. He passed it out. He retrieved the money for the drugs. That's without Mr. Epps' testimony at all, showing that Mr. Wilson is an integral part of the conspiracy, not just a sole dealer. And as far as Mr. Thomas, that the Epps notes were not prejudicial to him, the government had the testimony of one of the agents who did a hand-to-hand buy for Mr. Thomas and for Mr. Thomas's nephew, who identified Mr. Thomas as the person in the video who was selling the drugs to the agent. And during that transaction, Mr. Thomas saw the agent and the informant get out of a truck, told the agent to get back in the truck, sold the agent some crack, and then told the informant to go back into the building to get the remainder of the drugs that the informant was looking for. In addition, in a subsequent or an additional transaction, Mr. Thomas attempted to intervene in a drug deal that was occurring in the 340 building between some other gang members. The government presented testimony of the co-defendants who testified that the building was controlled by the gangster disciples. To sell drugs in the building, you had to be a member or an associate. You had to abide by certain rules, including working security, paying dues, selling Nation's work, and rules like that. And if you didn't, there were violations associated with that. In order for Mr. Thomas to even sell drugs at that building that was controlled by the gangster disciple, it's clear that he was a member of this conspiracy, in addition to the fact that he's directing other people to go purchase drugs inside the building. Moving to the Booker argument, it is the government's position that Mr. Wilson's attorney did not properly preserve a Booker objection. He did, throughout the sentencing of Mr. Wilson, he did object that there was not a preponderance of the evidence to support the decision the district court was making. However, he was not objecting that that the guidelines application is mandatory, were unconstitutional, or that the judge was relying on information not found by the jury. He did challenge the fact that hearsay information, he was challenged the sufficiency or the reliability of the hearsay information that the district court relied upon, specifically grand jury testimony and statements by the probation officer. However, he framed this within the context of, well, it's just not sufficient for preponderance of the evidence. Accordingly, the government submits that the plain error review applies. The government does concede that Mr. Wilson and Armstead would be entitled to a limited Palladino remand. And as the court pointed out, the district court can, well, two things. One, the district court can consider the additional 3553A factors, or it can make the determination that it just does not know whether it would have done the same sentence had it known the guidelines were not mandatory. And it can always ask, this court can always vacate the sentence and ask for a full resentencing.
I thought you were conceding that Wilson, Armstead, and Cohn were entitled to Palladino.
Actually, it's the government's position that Mr. Cohn has waived a Palladino remand because he had a full appellate waiver in his plea agreement. So to the extent that the court finds that Mr. Cohn's appellate waiver is not valid, then he would be entitled to a Palladino remand. But the second argument of the government's brief is that Mr. Cohn, who executed a full waiver in his plea agreement, has waived the right to a Booker challenge.
Now I'm just looking at your brief, which on pages 48 and so on isn't really saying that.
It's the issue just before the issue.
The district court could determine whether it would be a resentencing, for example, for Mr. Wilson. If he said, I would not have given the same sentence, then you go back to a resentencing.
Yes, Your Honor, and at that point, Mr. Wilson would be able to present any information that he's requesting to present. And in addition, it's really unclear, or there's been no argument made, as to why Mr. Wilson did not just present the information that he at least proffers that he'd like to present. At the time of the sentencing, 3553A was still good law, and the defendant had the opportunity to present any extraneous or other information that would have fallen under those categories at that time. And in fact, as the defendant Armstead presented a litany of arguments that would have been outside the general guideline consideration at that time.
And getting back to Cohen, he never tried to attack the plea agreement in any way, did he?
No, Your Honor. And this court's precedent has said that a proper appellate waiver waives an appellant's right to challenge raise a Booker challenge. Getting to Mr. Armstead's argument as to the drug amount, as this court pointed out, Mr. Armstead was not held accountable for the total amount of the drugs during the entire course of the conspiracy. The district court looked to the limited time period during which he was a member of the conspiracy, and it went into a very detailed explanation as to how it arrived at the drug amount. But in essence, given the testimony of just even one or two of the individuals, or one or two of the sellers who provided information as to the amount they were able to sell at the 340 building during just that 1 year time period, their individual amounts would go over 1.5 kilograms, let alone the combined amount of the approximately 30 people that were selling crack cocaine at the 340 building. In addition, as to it being reasonably foreseeable to Mr. Armstead that much drugs would be sold at the 340 building, again, at the October 2nd, 2001 meeting, Mr. Armstead presented over a meeting of approximately 30 people who were involved in sales at the 340 building and encouraged them to sell Nation's work and that they'd have enough time to sell their own drugs. And he also advised them that if they sold better cocaine, they could increase their profits, and that if they spread out, they would be able to sell more. Also, as the governor of the West Side, Mr. Armstead, there was testimony controlled more than just the drug locations at the 340 building. He controlled drug locations on the West Side. And during his recorded conversations again with Mr. Collins, he repeatedly said that he informed Mr. Collins that they would create new avenues so that everyone could make money by selling drugs and that he had multiple locations to sell drugs. As such, the government believes that it was foreseeable that at least 1.5 kilograms of crack cocaine would have been sold during Mr. Armstead's tenure. And as to the issue of transcripts, as I've pointed out, Mr. Armstead's own witness said that the transcripts, you could hear what was going on in the transcripts. They were not admitted as evidence. They were merely provided to the jury as an aid in listening to the tapes.
And the jury took them back to deliberate?
Initially, they did not. They sent a note and then asked for the transcript binders, and then the court sent them back.
Okay.
And for these reasons, the government requests that the court affirm the findings of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time? You have 2 minutes, Mr. Goodman.
Returning to the Brady issue, Your Honors, neither Mr. Wilson's guilty pleas to drug sales nor the evidence of drug sales generally against the three defendants is evidence that of conspiracy. You have to be an airline to operate at O'Hare, but that hardly means that United and American conspire with each other. They compete with each other, even though they occasionally cooperate. When flights are overbooked, airplanes have mechanical difficulties and so forth, they are still competing with each other. And a reasonable jury could have concluded that even if you had to be a gangster disciple, or even if most, if not all, of these people were gangster disciples, that in the main, these people were competing with each other and not conspiring with each other.
But and that theory certainly was before the jury.
Certainly. And that's why the Epps, was there something more you were going to say?
Yeah, no, Had something that the trial court done prevented you from offering that alternative interpretation of the facts to the jury, I'd be very concerned. But it seems to me, again, we're talking here at the margins. I mean, you obviously think it's a big margin, and the district court thought it was a small one.
Right. But this was the predominant basis of the defense's theory at trial. And the fact that the jury believed Mr. Epps, despite the disclosed impeachment, makes a suppressed impeachment all that much more important. I would direct, in closing on this point, I would direct the court's attention to the Ninth Circuit's decision in Horton versus Mayle, which is cited by in Mr. Thomas's reply brief. This is a Ninth Circuit decision from 2004 involving Brady. And the Ninth Circuit concluded that the jury had other reasons to disbelieve McLaurin, the person comparable to Epps, does not render the suppressed evidence immaterial. The suppressed evidence is a wholly different type of impeachment evidence from which the jury reasonably could have inferred that McLaurin had an interest in fabricating his testimony. As I think we all recognize, this evidence is qualitatively and quantitatively different than any other evidence. This sort of puppet master, marionette, there's nothing comparable was pointed out by either the government or the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Our thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.